From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Washington lawmakers are working for better representation for Latinos in Hollywood. Then filmmaker James Mangold wanted to capture auto racing from the driver's perspective in his new movie, Ford vs. Ferrari.
If I'm going to make a sports movie and my shooting style of the sport is going to look the same as what you'd see on your weekend sports broadcast, it may just be my own sense of pride, but I feel like I failed.
And on this Veterans Day, we hear from some vets who have turned their experiences into theater. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Latinos have been underrepresented in Hollywood for a long time, both in front of and behind the camera. Last week, a delegation from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus came to L.A. to discuss the issue with industry leaders. Congressman Joaquin Castro of San Antonio is chairman of the group, and he says the Hispanic Caucus has a couple of concerns about representation.
We went to Los Angeles on two issues in particular. The gross underrepresentation of Latinos in the entertainment industry. And the second is portrayal of Latinos in television and film. For example, this latest Annenberg report found that of the Latino lead characters on film, 28% played criminals, which is obviously for any American community or segment of society, a misrepresentation. And so we had meetings with six or seven studios and executives from those studios. We met with a few of the guilds, the Screen Actors Guild, SAG-AFTRA, and the Directors Guild. And we had a chance to meet with about 40 Latino actors, actresses, producers, directors, and others about the Hollywood ecosystem and the challenges that they face getting work in that system.
It's not just the kinds of parts that Latinos are getting, it's the number of parts. Latino actors barely got 4.5% of the more than 47,000 speaking roles in the top 100 grossing movies from each of the past 12 years. And Latinos make up a huge percentage, not only of the U.S. population, but also of the movie-going public. It's almost a quarter of all ticket buyers are Latinos.
Right.
So was there any explanation about that disconnect?
Yeah, I mean, we had pleasant meetings with everyone, and everybody talked about the things they're doing to try to do better. I can't say that there was a satisfactory answer to that issue. They did talk about their different pipelines for writing, for directing, for, you know, this and that, that they're working on. But as I said to those folks in the meetings, look, if you're at 3% now of Latinos in front of the camera and behind the camera, then whatever you've been doing in the past obviously has not worked. So what are you doing right now, and what do you plan to do to improve those numbers? And it's very strange that an industry like Hollywood that's considered liberal and progressive, that it would have worse numbers than the fossil fuel industry, the oil and gas industry in my home state of Texas.
The numbers obviously don't lie. The representation of Latinos, along with a lot of underrepresented groups in Hollywood, is terrible. Why is it important that it change, and why is it important to you personally?
Well, there is a cost to that underrepresentation in C-suites, in terms of casting directors, producers, et cetera. And part of that cost is a misportrayal of Latinos. I think it not only affects how people see themselves, but also how the larger American public sees the Latino community. So when a president or a politician or anyone else gets up and says that Latinos are criminals and rapists or murderers, and then people turn on their television set and they go to a movie and that's exactly what they see, then it affirms that idea for them that the person who's speaking is right. And taken to its extreme, it leads to what you got in El Paso, Texas a few months ago, which is a madman driving 10 hours to kill 21 people because he sees Hispanics as invaders to the United States. Never mind that Latinos have been here for generations. And so Hollywood has to take a really deep and close look in the mirror and start to change, and change sincerely, not just by lip service, but actually change.
And how do you think that will come about? Because we've had study after study for the last decade that's pointed out these numbers, and it doesn't seem like the needle is moving. Do you see any hope for optimism?
I was optimistic after those conversations in terms of Congress's involvement. Congress does have jurisdiction over tax incentives that are provided to the film industry, just like different state legislatures have jurisdiction over tax incentives that are offered in different places where movies and television productions are set. But I did tell some of the folks in these meetings that for us, for those of us that were on that trip for the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and I think for, I would dare say, for many other members of Congress, what we have is a Mark Zuckerberg-level problem here in terms of Hollywood. We have a problem where an industry is acting incredibly irresponsibly and doesn't seem to be doing very much to change it. So the idea that you would bring executives from Hollywood in front of Congress, the Judiciary Committee is the committee that has jurisdiction basically over Hollywood, that idea, I think, is something that we should consider.
Let's assume that these Hollywood executives who aren't really doing what maybe they should be doing were to testify in front of Congress. What would you ask them?
Congress has brought different industries in front of it to question them on their practices in terms of hiring and diversity and what commitment they're making to those things. And so I would ask them questions about the processes they put in place. I mean, look, when you're in a city that is 40% Latino, in a state that's 40% Latino, a country that's 18%, movie ticket buyers that are 23% over-indexed on movie ticket sales, and this group of people only has about 3% of the roles when you combine in front of and behind the camera, you get to a point where you have to admit that that's systemic exclusion of a group of people. And when we have systemic problems, not just individual problems or one person here or there, when you have systemic problems, those are the kinds of things that Congress and legislatures should get involved with.
Joaquin Castro represents San Antonio in the U.S. House of Representatives. He also chairs the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Congressman, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, writer-director James Mangold puts us in the front seat for his new movie, Ford vs. Ferrari. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Ford versus Ferrari is, as the title suggests, the story of how Ford entered the 1966 Le Mans automobile race in an attempt to defeat the reigning champion of sports car racing, Ferrari. The story centers on the relationship between the men who took up the seemingly impossible challenge, race car designer Carroll Shelby, played by Matt Damon, and driving legend Ken Miles, who's played by Christian Bale. Together, they built and raced the car that we now know as the Ford GT. I met with director James Mangold not too long ago.
Where are we, James? I want you to describe the
scene.
We're
in a meadow. We're in a meadow looking at some aspens and...
We were at the Telluride Film Festival, where Ford versus Ferrari had its world premiere.
So are you at all a car nut? Can you tell the difference between a Chevy and a Ford and an Impala?
Spectrum of car expertise, being able to tell the difference between a Chevy and a Ford is low.
Set the bar low.
Yeah, you set the bar very low. Car nut, I would say no, I'm not a car nut, although I got much more into it making the film.
How did the story come to you? What was your
I read the script 2011, there was a script floating around. What attracted me about the script wasn't just the car thing, but was the unique characters. This kind of ensemble of hot rodders and veterans and British and Southern California and Italians and perfectionists and corporate types. And I saw so much of, frankly, I connected with it on the even through the prism of our own business, watching, you know, this effort to build a car is not unlike the effort to make a movie, and all the different personalities are involved in bringing it to marketplace. The artists, the marketeers, the naysayers, the cynics, the idealists, the believers, the romantics, the crazies, These are all part of our life too. And in a way it seemed like a kind of beautiful allegory for me. Also, what was interesting on the level of why the movie hadn't happened, which is that no one had pulled the trigger on the movie because it had cost every version that anyone was doing was costing too much. And I think the one thing, and this actually brings me back to your question, was that the one thing that really helped me in not being a car nut was that when I went through the script and tried to kind of pare it down to its essence, I wasn't that guy who was haunted by, oh, I can't cut that. Oh, I can't, that has to be in the movie. Meaning I had the objectivity to kind of see the movie more than the kind of being such a car racing nut that I couldn't let go of anything, which all the expense of the movie was the racing. And so, well, you'll know when you see it. It's the movie's kind of a Private Ryan in reverse. It's a pretty much a straight ahead character piece ending with an hour of nonstop racing.
But you do something with the racing, you and your cinematographer, Finn Papamichael, and that is you shoot the races from the racer's perspective. We don't have these overhead shots of hundreds of cars. You are taking the viewer into the car so that he or she is in with your racer, Ken Miles.
Absolutely, John. I think that to me, on a sheer ego level, if I'm going to make a sports movie and my shooting style of the sport is going to look the same as what you'd see on your weekend sports broadcast, then it may just be my own sense of pride, but I feel like I've failed. But secondly, the movie was about these guys and these guys pushing these cars to their limit, but also subtleties. You know, Ken Miles was a great racer and a great engineer, but his greatest competition was with himself. And I think we make that pretty clear in the movie. You know, he was trying to top himself. He didn't care about the marketing. He didn't care about the rankings. He didn't care about fame. He just had a goal of being as good as he could be and better than he was yesterday. And that, even saying that, how could I ever show anything like that if I'm not in that cab with him?
You cast Tracy Letts as Henry Ford II, and there's a scene that I will just say where Henry Ford II is in a car going very fast.
You ready?
I was born ready, Mr. Shelby. Hit it.
And I'm watching that scene, and I'm not sure if I'm watching Henry Ford II in a car or Tracy Letts in a car, because it feels like what is happening in real time, and the actor and the character are both panicked by what is happening.
Well, I don't know that Tracy was really panicked, but I will say that Tracy was using what we were giving him, and he did play the scene. We took him for Mr. Toad's Wild Ride in that car, and kept the camera running after it stopped.
You mentioned this kind of comparison to movie making. So if Carroll Shelby, is he the producer and Ken Miles is the director?
Well, these parallels aren't perfect, meaning that, the really interesting story about Carroll Shelby's younger years, and that's who Matt Damon plays in the movie, is that he had a heart condition and didn't know it, and in the height of his racing career was alerted that if he ever raced again, he'd die. So he had to quit racing, and so all that ambition and drive and risk-seeking all had to get pushed into design and salesmanship. And so in many ways, his relationship with Christian's character, Ken Miles, it becomes a kind of surrogate for him who gets to do what he can't do anymore. But when you ask the question about the studio, yeah, I guess Ken could be the difficult actor, and Shelby is the producer/director trying to hold it all together, deliver the message he wants, but has to deal with the suits and all their unusual demands at the same time.
Nothing in there about my trunk and your lovely little portmanteau.
You're holding the 62 edition of the SCCA.
You can stick this bloody sticker where the sun
Bill. Hey, right. Bill, what seems to be the problem, Bill?
Well, the problem is that Bill here is an asshole.
No, he doesn't mean that.
No, yes, he does.
No,
yes,
really
he does. Yes,
that.
No, he
He's
really does
you,
think
Bill.
That He's Bill is an asshole.
I'm just doing my job here.
Bill, in my experience, there is, listen to me, something like this, there's always a middle ground. Mm-hmm. All right, now Ken's out of line.
And I'm just doing my job.
I understand you are. You know how he gets on a race day.
You know that, all right? But you're not going to DQ us over a trunk.
happy, Bill?
Yeah, I'll handle it.
We're talking with James Mangold about his new movie, Ford v. Ferrari. So when you're thinking about the sound design of the film, you have the elements of racing and the motor sounds, screeching, you know, pavement, those kinds of things. And then you have score. What was the overall design of the sound of the film?
Well, my team and I put a lot of effort in the sound on every movie, but this is the kind of movie where your people are going to notice. And I say that because sound is such a character in racing itself. You know, a Ferrari does not sound like a Ford, and each of their braking systems are exclusive to those cars. And each road is different. Gravel, hard pavement, oil pavement. Is it echoing in a stadium situation? Is it a wide open road? Is it raining? All these things have a huge effect. Also, all the power tools and welders and lifts and all that stuff is really fun on the sound level of a picture. And you forget the wind and the chassis rattling. And so it kind of comes naturally that the picture becomes a symphony. What we were most focused on, though, was not the snaz, but really kind of creating the personality of these cars. And again, we wanted to place you in the car, and we wanted the sound to do the same thing.
This is well before there are any women racing and there are any women working at Ford Motor Company. And there are a lot of guys in suits, and there are a lot of guys in fireproof suits racing cars.
There's a lot of guys.
How do you make sure that even though that is historically what is happening, that this is not testosterone and cars, that there is an aspect of family and parenting, that it's not just about guys racing cars and men being men?
Well, I don't think, I think in the end, you don't want to ever make a dramatic decision just on the sheer basis of kind of mixing up the sexes. You want to make it make sense for the story. Because in a way, the best statement I could make about how backward the world was then in terms of sexism is to really show how segregated it was. So that it's like, I don't want to ameliorate that on one side and lose the sense for the audience that, man, that was a white guy's world then. But at the second part you're asking about, it was really important in telling Ken's story. His family was critical, and his family story was critical. And in Katrina Balfe and Noah Jupe, but we had phenomenal actors to play his family, and I think bring a lot of heart. But also, Katrina's tough and real. And
this is Ken Miles' wife.
She plays Molly, Ken Miles' wife, and she's just phenomenal in the part.
Another satisfied customer.
Can I help you, miss?
Wasn't that an MGA 1500?
Ah, you know your cars.
I like them. I love the sound they make, the way it goes right through you.
Right.
That vibration.
Wait a second. What type of girl are you?
Type of girl who likes the smell of wet gasoline.
Oh.
Burnt rubber.
Oh, what are you, some kind of a deviant, are you?
Well, only since I married you.
Let me ask you this last question. You teach film, and is there a scene that you would teach out of Ford versus Ferrari that might have been a really difficult scene to pull off that you think you could talk about in a classroom? And what would that talk be about, and what scene would you pick?
Well, usually when I do a class, I'll actually pick a fairly simple scene. That as directors, it's not always the stuff that everyone notices with the flying camera flying through the window or through a keyhole that is filmmaking. It's actually, how do you handle a kitchen scene? Or how do you handle, you know, one of my favorite scenes in the picture. It's very simple. It's just Christian and Matt in a Mexican diner discussing the future of the movie. But it's like, for me, what I treasure and what I value is how well a director does those simple things, because the other stuff is all previs to the nine, second unit, splicing it up. CG can come in and fix whatever you broke, but just human beings moving around. You know, one of the things I think Steven Spielberg never gets acknowledgement for, because his movies are so spectacle oriented usually, is that no one's better at moving the actors around. Just a simple scene of Indy Jones packing before he goes off across the Atlantic is a tapestry of blocking, crosses, move closer to camera, away from camera. That's what I try and focus on, is how much you can do with how little.
James, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, man. Good to be here.
That was James Mangold. His film Ford versus Ferrari opens on November 15th.
Up next on The Frame, on Veterans Day, some vets turn to ancient Greek dramas to help tell their own stories. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. Here's our final story today, and it's about Veterans Day. It starts with this question. Can stories spoken thousands of years ago help today's veterans process their warfare experiences? In Los Angeles, a group of vets are updating and performing Greek dramas about war. The ancient wisdom helps them feel that they're not alone in suffering their traumas, and moving the plays to present-day L.A. helps them feel more at home. Isaiah Murtaugh prepared this story on the warrior bards.
George Cantero wears his gray hair long. He's got a white beard and hazel eyes that hide a treasure trove of stories. He reads his poetry, and the room gets quieter. The air gets thicker.
We're on the tarmac, waiting for the plane. I hear the thump, thump, thump of the chopper as they load off the dead. Grim reminders of the wasted, grotesque mass of the dead.
Back in 1971, Cantero was just 18. He left home.
I hopped a bird and went to the Republic of Vietnam.
He got shipped off to be a combat medic.
And nothing eventful happened there except for a couple of firefights, some incoming, and the spring offensive of 1972.
But even a couple of firefights had a lasting impact.
I remember it when I'm fighting, to tell you the truth. If I'm threatened by any way, then it comes back very strongly and it puts me into defense mode.
Cantero joined the Screen Actors Guild.
I was in Apocalypse Now.
He's a soldier in a chaotic nighttime battle scene. A friendly boat passes by and he jumps into the river, screaming at the top of his lungs.
Take me home!
Take me home, he cries. That boat drifts on without him. Now, Cantero's home, at least in body. To help himself heal from Vietnam, he acts, writes, and plays a little music.
Heroes all of both sides, to Hades, the land we dread. I hear the thump, thump, thump of the choppers and the screaming inside my head.
Cantero and about a dozen other U.S. military vets have been working since August on an original theater production. They are reworking, for our time, 3,000-year-old Greek war dramas. Nate Grazer organized this group to help veterans tell their stories.
And there's something that happens in a human soul when you've sort of seen the worst that you can treat each other.
Grazer says that when soldiers come home from war, they don't always come all the way home because they haven't really dealt with what they went through.
You have to re-enter society as this sort of new person and figure out a way to make sense of your experience and you now in a world that you see differently.
The ancient Greek plays were cathartic then, and they still are.
These plays were developed as like an ancient tool for helping unpack and process war and homecoming.
Act one, scene one, Phil stands outside.
The warrior bards meet in a basement classroom. They cluster around a table, turn off the main lights in the room, and work in low light. They read through drafts of their stories. Cantero is the lead in a scene adapted from the Greek war tragedy Philoctetes. That one's about a war veteran with a foot injury on the island of Lemnos. This time, instead of Lemnos, it's the streets of Skid Row. Instead of a foot injury, it's homelessness. His scene opens with a TV reporter thanking the soldier for his service.
Don't thank me. Value me. Value us. Bumper stickers, flags waving on your houses. They don't house us. We fought wars. What have you fought for? Certainly not us.
The scene ends when a rep from the Veterans Administration visits him, outside his tent on the sidewalk in Skid Row. She's played by another former combat medic, Mia Rivera.
You've been by yourself out here the whole time?
There was a veteran in a tent not too far from where you're sitting for a couple of years. Tent burned down in front of me with him in it. Never saw who lit the match.
Phil goes silent. Nia sits with him in silence.
If you know Yvette, ask them for a story. Then listen close. It might help to bring them back all the way home.
We stand upon the tarmac, lamenting for our friends. A jet arrives in silence, the bird that takes us home.
That story was produced by Isaiah Murtaugh. He's a graduate student at the USC Annenberg School of Journalism. For more information, visit warriorbards.org. And if you want to hear a great album that was recorded in collaboration with veterans, check out Mary Gaucher's Rifles and Rosary Beads.
Rifles and rosary beads, you hold on to what you need.
And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn at the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Rifles and rosary beads.